I'm Elena.
I'm Grant.
And this is Whiskers. We share knowledge regarding SeaQuest.
Hello, everyone. We are here yet again. But before we start sharing our SeaQuest knowledge, there are two things that I think people have been dying to hear more about. First, there was a bit of an argument about a point of factual interest. In our last recording.
Yeah, there was.
On the episode Dead End.
Uh-huh.
The point of disagreement was whether Brody asked Lucas or Henderson to be his roommate at the sexual harassment conference. It's still amazing to me that the inciting incident of the whole thing is a sexual harassment conference.
And I was insistent that as the person who has watched SeaQuest every year for 30 years, that it was Lucas he was talking to. And you're like, no, it's Henderson. It's Henderson. You're wrong. It's Henderson.
I don't think I ever said you were wrong. I just insisted
I was
right. Okay, I probably did.
You said I was wrong. Because you said it was Henderson. You
have a record of being incorrect on this point. Yes, we did rewatch it.
Who was right?
You were right,
dear.
I
was right.
You were right.
Thank you. Thank you.
What happens is they're talking about this plan, and then Henderson chimes in with her ability to rig any two systems together, just like down on the farm. And following her line...
Following. Because the response is to Lucas.
The response is to Lucas. You can tell by Brody's eye line and the direction of his gesture.
He's pointing up at Lucas in the pod, not Henderson off to the opposite side.
But you can understand, while my attention is divided between the action and my notes, why I missed the gesture and assumed he was speaking to the person who had most recently spoken.
And you can understand why I'm insulted that you would not, that you would not believe me, the lifelong watcher of this show who has seen all of it numerous times over the past 30 years compared to you who has watched it now twice.
I mean, one and a half if we're being particular.
You were in your second viewing, but I must be wrong.
Thank you,
and
dear.
When I'm insistent that I know this scene, I know who it is, you still tell me I'm wrong.
It would have been funnier if he was talking to Henderson.
No, he's proud that he's Lucas's roommate. Okay. He picked the smart boy. Yeah, you're gonna save us. You'll get us out of here. You have the ideas.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Lonnie. I was sure it was going to be a room with two beds, but needs must. Come on.
You should listen to me. That's what the lesson of this is you should listen to me.
Anyhow, the second point I want to circle back to is, darling, over the last while, I have taken on the role of helping you through your journey to follow the life and times of Shar Aznable, the sassy line boy.
Yes.
And I'm sure there's a number of listeners who would like to know your continuing and evolving thoughts on the sassy wine boy, Shar Aznable, the Red Comet, Casval Rem Daikun, Edouard Moss. So for the record, you have seen Shar in the flashback segments of G-Quux.
Yes. And that's when I was like, my boy.
Yes. Immediately.
Immediately. My boy. And then I was like, where'd he go?
Instant brainwaves. Where is he?
Where is he?
No one knows. It's like watching The French Connection. Where's Roy? But more recently, you have watched the compilation film trilogy of the original Mobile Suit Gundam from 1979.
Yes.
Although the films, I guess, it's like 1980 through 82.
Yes.
As well as 1988's Char's Counterattack.
Yes.
That is where you're at.
Yes.
What are your now evolved and continued thoughts?
He's still my boy. I love that boy. I love everything about that sassy boy.
What are some of your favorite moments about the sassy boy?
Love his look.
Mm-hmm.
I love his look.
And by that, you mean his one-year war look. You like the helmet, you like the mask.
I like the helmet, I like that mask. Have you ever seen him without that helmet on? No.
I mean, fairly often.
Not that often, okay? It should be never. It should be never, honestly.
He should have worn it in the shower scene, is what you're saying.
Yes! Nothing else, completely naked. He wears it when he has sex. It's helmet and mask say on. But we can't have a perfect world. It's fine.
Who is he having sex with, dear?
Oh, there are options.
All right, who's your top three?
That one dude? The dude that dies.
Garma. Listeners don't know, she mimed the hair curl?
Yes.
That's how I knew she meant Garma?
That dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, ooh. I get the Amuro thing.
Right?
I get it. I'm coming to it. I was a little like, he a baby.
He, like...
But I'm getting there. That's understandable.
That is another difference. Like, you see Amuro on normal days more, whatever normal counts for, if you watch the TV series.
Mm.
Like, if you just see... He's breaking down...
He's just running away from women.
He's constantly running away from women.
That's all he's doing is running away terrified from women. Which, you know what?
Perhaps into the arms
of like, it makes sense. He's there. He's there to comfort him. He's ready.
Uh-huh. He knows how to change a tire.
Okay, I fucking love... Yeah. He's a horse boy?
He's a horse boy.
He's a horse boy. I love that he's a horse boy. I love that he just rides around in that damn car in that outfit.
Yeah.
And is just like, yes, I will change this tire.
Or driving a covered wagon one time.
Or the fucking wagon. Which, if you're following me on Blue Sky, you know that I fully believe that his American girl of choice is Kirsten. They connect on the fact of pioneer travel.
Nowhere
and,
else.
And losing friends. Tragically.
Nowhere else do you get this analysis. I'm sorry, Tom and Nina on a Mobile Suit Breakdown are not talking American Girl dolls. They're just not.
The tragedy of lost friends. Suddenly, he gets it. She gets it. They come together in this bond.
Mm-hmm. Not for long.
Runner-up is Felicity because she is a horse girl and he is a horse boy.
Naturally. They'd have so much to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. She also has funky hats.
But before you watched more of the source material, I was asking you, what is it that drew you so strongly to Char?
He's a sassy wine boy.
That came down to is you just really love an evil little gay boy who...
I love an evil little gay boy.
Who wants to make problems on purpose for fun?
Yes.
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 So if anyone listening has any recommendations for other things Elena might enjoy, one of these days we're going to go through Zeta. I think you love him so much you have to see him in his sleeveless era.
I absolutely want to see this.
Okay.
Yes. But I want to see this so bad.
But if you, the listener out there, have your own favorite evil little gay boys who make problems on purpose for fun,
I welcome them.
Just send them along. Yeah. Perhaps in the text of your 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Perhaps.
Perhaps. Perhaps. You know, it works. You can also tell me what American Girl they relate to. That might help.
Mm-hmm,
it might bring me along for this ride.
Just as a way to test the vibe. And Yeah. You learn a lot about a person by their favorite American Girl doll character.
Yes.
Anyhow, that brings us to Sequest DSV Season 2, Episode 11, Meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
This is written by Tom Salozzi, who is writer and story editor on the A-Team, writer and producer on The Torkelsons.
That's the one.
And went on to write 2 of the very early episodes of Voyager.
When you're like, it's a show that only you have ever talked about. Mm-hmm. I love The Torkelsons.
Of course you do.
I do.
I've never heard anyone in the world mention The Torkelsons but you.
Now, here's your fact about the Torkelsons. Technically, there were 2 seasons.
Sure.
The first one was the Torkelsons. The second one, they renamed to Coming Home. They lost 2 of the kids, and then Brittany Murphy was in it.
So it's a Sequest 2032 situation.
Yes.
big cast turnover, change the name.
Yeah.
And Brittany Murphy's in it.
Yeah, Brittany Murphy became in it because in season one of the Torkelsons, they're living in their big house and they're trying to make ends meet because the whole thing is about the single mom, like with all her kids, trying to make ends meet with what they can, and they have to take in a boarder, and Boarder Hodges, call him. Okay. But season two, they have to like move because like they can't afford their house anymore, and there's like no other explanation than that. And I guess she sells a couple kids. I don't know. They end up moving to like the suburbs and she becomes the housekeeper for this rich dude who has two kids, one of which is Brittany Murphy.
They should both be Brittany Murphy and they're not twins.
Although their one's a boy.
She could do it.
What's his name? He's been in shit.
Anyhow, while you check that, this episode of Sequest is directed by Anson Williams, who went on to direct things like 90210, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Baywatch, and 31 episodes of The Secret Life of the American Teenager.
Mm.
Now, if you recognize the name Anson Williams, you're probably wondering why I'm talking about his director's career, because he is best known as Potsy in Happy Days.
Ah.
It's Potsy time, boy!
Oh, excuse me, it was almost home, not coming home. I got the name wrong. I sometimes am wrong. Not about the Sequest, though. Oh, it's Jason Marsden, who did the voice of Max in a Goofy movie.
He was everywhere around that time.
Yes, he did all that stuff. He was the brother
of
Brittany Murphy.
Sure, sure.
It's a good show. It was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm,
I liked it. Yeah.
So by the combined powers of the producer of the Torkelsons and Potsy,
we get this episode.
We get Meltdown.
Yes. Which, Meltdown is such a weird name for this episode in a lot of ways.
It's very literally applicable.
Like, it makes sense, but it is not the name I would think of because what it applies to is why we got here, but it's never what we're actually dealing with.
Right, right.
Which is why it's a weird name.
It brings to mind...
like nuclear.
Yeah,
or,
exactly.
Or a
and
plant.
That is not relevant. There are emotions running hot, but I would not say any character experiences a meltdown.
No.
Either.
No.
Although there's tension, that's to be sure.
There's some tension. There's some drama.
Anyhow, we begin in the Ford Freeport aquaculture zone in the South Atlantic.
Yeah, we got some scuba divers who are doing a sand sample.
They're taking samples. They're sampling the sand.
Mm-hmm.
And as they surface and chit-chat some exposition about these samples, we learn that someone has been dumping in the ocean, causing a crop loss at their aquaculture fields.
Those jerks.
And the lady diver, Jenna, assumes it's Sea Mine, a very creatively named company.
Who does mining.
Where do they do that?
In the sea.
Oh!
For what? We don't fucking know. We never learn.
But they dump their waste, and not always properly, which causes crop loss, and they're very frustrated. This lady's ready to fight.
Yeah. So their sample is contaminated, and she's like, oh, it's totally them. On their little radar, there's a big mass coming across the radar, and they're like, oh, that's probably them in, like, a sub. They're here.
Mm-hmm,
so she's
mm-hmm.
like, I'm going to go back down there with this undersea camera, and I'm going to get photos of those assholes.
Mm-hmm.
So she does that where the guy stays above.
Now, the lady diver here is named Jenna, and she is played by Dorian Field, who will later have a recurring role on Sequest as a background player, Helmswoman Tyler.
Oh.
So keep an eye out for a Helmswoman named Tyler, and it'll be the same later.
Okay. So she goes back down below, and while she's down there, we suddenly get the perspective of an evil something.
You know it's evil because it's red.
Because the eyesight is red. It's monster vision is red. And so we get several shots of it, and we see that it's lurking behind her, and it's going to come up, and then we cut to the guy on the boat who's on the radar, like, turn around, Jenna! Turn around! And she's not turning around.
As this big blue smudge on the radar goes over her, she gets eaten by a smudge.
She gets eaten by a smudge, and then parts of her scuba suit and her shoes like float to the surface, and the guy's like, oh my god, Jenna, and he like pulls them up, and as he does that, suddenly this evil sea monster thing comes up and he screams, and there's a big chomp noise with red monster vision.
Now, unlike the episode By Any Other Name, the thing we're getting a point of view from has eyes. It's fine. It's better. It's good now.
Does it? Yeah.
At least two of them. I don't want to ruin the surprise.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the credits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So after the opening credits, we see some footage of someone, their point of view of jogging and other people jogging with them. Mm-hmm. But this is not actually someone jogging in, like, outside, because there is suddenly, like, stats in the eyes.
Mm-hmm,
and we find out that it is Ford jogging on the treadmill with a VR set that's giving him, like, trail pictures.
Do you wish your running app had VR support so you could always see your pace and like, your elevation?
No, because here's the deal. Is I do not need Garmin in my everyday life. Like, my watch already fucking yells at me that I'm, like, being a lazy piece of shit all the time and that I'm stressed and need to, like, breathe. I don't need that, like, popping up in my vision while I'm driving or some shit. Like, you're lazy. Walk more. Okay, also breathe more because you're too stressed. Your heart rate's really high right now. Like, yes, my heart rate is high. You're popping messages in my vision while I'm trying to merge. No, thank you.
But Ford finds it relaxing.
If you're not someone that's involved in endurance sports,
mm-hmm.
The Garmin watch
is
known for being really mean. Like, really mean.
Like, really mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyways.
So he's running, and he gets interrupted with a ping from Ortiz trying to pass along a message. He's got someone on hold.
Mm-hmm.
You know how this is Ortiz's job? O'Neill is in the scene, leaning over, being Ortiz's station buddy.
See, they're...
They should switch!
They're having a day where they try to be each other. They're kind of bored.
Okay.
O'Neill is like, hey, Ortiz, I want to know what it's like to be a sexy man with muscles. I want to pretend to be you and sit at your station.
Okay, okay.
And Ortiz is like,
okay, sure, then I'll sit at your station, but that means he has to route the calls. And then O'Neill comes back over because he can't give up routing the calls. He loves to route the calls.
Yes, yes. Also, his little stick arms can't handle, like, all of Ortiz's switches. It's too many.
That's how he got all the muscles.
That's how he gets the muscles.
The whiskers don't have power steering. He's just pushing them through the ocean.
That's exactly it. There's a lot of muscle required to steer those whiskers around. And O'Neill isn't used to it. He's just used to his little button. Uh-huh, I hit a button.
Learning Vietnamese over the course of 4 hours.
It also explains why. So in this scene.
Yeah.
Okay. In a second. We're going to come back to what it explains.
Yes, sure.
Okay. Because what happens is, you know, Ford's like, I'm busy. And he's like, no, they've been on hold a long time. It's your father. And he's like, I know.
Mm-hmm. Don't want to talk to his dad. Do not want to talk to his dad.
So he's like, fine, I'll take it. Give me a secure line in my quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And which O'Neill has to make a comment of, like, that's weird. And he's like, they have a special relationship. Shh.
I'd want a secure line to talk to my dad, too. My dad's not your business, Ted Raimi.
Also, he's an officer, so he doesn't have to take it in the mess. He can take it in his fucking room. Okay? But here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ortiz, because this isn't his station, fucks up transferring the call.
That's true.
What happens is the call goes through still to the workout room. And Tony wanders up to this room, like this call, which is showing like this lovely beach.
You know, sometimes when you're just munching on a corn dog and you wander into a gym for no discernible reason?
Tony would.
Tony does.
Tony does. But that this is why. This explains it. Ortiz wasn't at his normal station. They swapped for the day. He messed up which room to send it to.
I mean, it forks because that beach image is waiting for Ford in his room, too. It's on both screens.
Yeah, but he messed it up. He got the transfer wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It all makes sense.
It all makes sense. It's perfectly logical.
But yeah. So Tony, though, here's the thing. Tony thinks that lifting that corn dog to his mouth is the equivalent of lifting weights.
Yeah, it's a small one, to be sure.
He's also like protein. This is my pre-workout protein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some carb.
You need your carbs, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a balanced meal, the corn dog.
Yes. So he is like, whoa, look at this beach. And then suddenly this dude appears and he's like, who are you? And the dude's like, who are you? It is Ford's father.
Tony Piccolo has such a chip on his shoulder. Like, you wandered into someone else's phone call. What are you doing? What is this?
Because it's a dad. He's like, I know.
He hates dads.
I hate dads.
He's got a problem with dads.
It's like, I bet you're an asshole too.
Are you a criminal or the other kind?
Only two options.
There's only two. It's
yeah.
Criminal asshole and regular asshole.
Did you spend time with your son? Did you ever throw him a baseball?
I don't think the answer is yes.
Okay, then there's more than two kinds.
I mean, I think, I you know what? No, I think Ford's dad played catch with him, but he provided extensive notes. And
yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Here's how to be better.
It's never good enough.
It explains why Ford is the way he is.
Anyhow, Father Ford here is played by J.A. Preston, who is hot off his most famous role, the judge in A Few Good Men.
Oh!
Yes!
Yeah!
Yeah, one of the best guys to ever say, I'll allow it. You better be going somewhere with this.
Doesn't say that to Ford. I'm not gonna allow bullshit.
So yeah, eventually, Tony Piccolo finishes his one scene this episode and just shuffles away.
He's in a couple background things.
This is the only time he's foreground.
Yes.
It's his one comic bit, and then we're done with him.
Well, and of course, his comic book has to end by getting, like, a gruff stare down by, I don't know, captain of the gym. He's like, why you got food in here? And so he's like, Dagwood, put this back where you got it from, and like hands off his corn dog before he runs away.
And Dagwood's like, okay, cool. Where did I get this from? And Dagwood will have this corn dog for the remainder of the episode.
Yes. It's going to be kind of smelly. This episode takes place over days, and he will have this corn dog.
He eats no more of the corn dog.
He carries it around like a boutonniere. It's because he doesn't know where it came from.
He's looking.
He's trying to find this. How many things did he try to, like, stick it into? How many outlets did he set off?
It's a good thing the handle is wooden.
Well, might catch on fire, though.
Sure.
It's a good thing he has this, like, mop of, like, soap.
So back in Ford's quarters, he begins this conversation, and it's basically like, son, some of your friends died. Come sort out my business. Also, fuck your brother.
Yeah. That's really it, honestly.
Because, of course, Ford Freeport is a family business. That's where the Ford comes from. When there's this big crisis, he needs his preferred son to come and work things out.
Obviously.
He can't rely on his other son, who's been in the business all these years, who's chief operating officer, and doesn't seem to be allowed to operate much.
No, that's one of those title-only things.
This is a point of contention between Ford and his father, and all three of... What do you think of the Ford family dynamic, before we get too deep into it?
It explains a lot about Ford. I think
this is some of the best character drama in the television program Sequest.
Yeah.
Like, this is such a realistic look at a family that does not like each other.
Ford will say it later on.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of spoilies. But he talks about loving his family, but not getting loving them from afar.
Yes.
And he never says that he doesn't like them.
Right.
And I think that's important, because I wouldn't say that they, like, It's not a mutual, they don't all like each other.
Right.
But there's a lack of getting along mm-hmm. and trust.
Yes.
And also a good acknowledgement here of, like, not trusting both of your children as adults
mm-hmm.
and treating them that way, right?
Like, all these three men,
mm-hmm.
the three links between them in the triangle, mm-hmm. all are strained in their own ways. And something yes. that I think is so smart and insightful about the way they're written is that the third one out in any of these pairs, like, can see how to fix it. But if they ever say anything, you know, one of them will snap like, hey, that's not your business.
Yes. Yes.
It's good. Yeah. It's good.
I don't know. I don't want to for them to say that they don't like each other
mm-hmm.
because they wouldn't. At the beginning,
mm-hmm.
there is definitely more not liking. But it's about coming together. And I don't think that they could come together in the way that they do if they really didn't like each other.
That's true. That's true.
I think it's more levels of things they need to work through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they can get over it and like each other more.
And especially that it's a work thing, because mm-hmm. a lot of their interpersonal issues are related to the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I love Ford, and I love when we let Ford do things.
Yes.
And he's just such a good actor.
Yes.
He's so fun to watch. Mm-hmm. He's so, like, charismatic to watch.
Yes.
And then he's also someone, though, you don't get that much insight into throughout episodes, like, on a personal level, right?
Mm-hmm,
so the
mm-hmm.
only way you're ever going to find out about Ford's family is to have an episode about Ford's family, because he's too professional to talk about his family at work.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, we would not get this type of insight. He's not going to be talking about any of this around the mess,
mm-hmm.
because he's too professional for that.
How hard was it for the writer's room to stop themselves from giving Ford a surprisingly young hot mom?
So hard.
Maybe in this case, it's a stepmom situation, and they don't have to do, like, a weird sci-fi thing this time.
No one person was like, okay, here's the deal. Ford's dad's going to call him up because he needs help.
But
and
also,
it's going to be,
Ford's dad has married someone his age, Ford's age.
Yes. And he's going to be like, your stepmother's pregnant.
And it's your brother's. And now Maury is happening?
And somehow it turned into this episode, because they were like, we've already done the, like, hot mom thing a few times. We can't have Ford have feelings about his mom. It's a line we're not willing to cross.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Ford would never.
And the one guy, whoever the one guy in that writer's room is, was like, well, if it's not biological, I'm not going to go to bat for it. It's fine,
it's
whatever.
It's fine.
It doesn't count anyway.
I guess. So Ford eventually agrees, yes, I will come for a couple days, even mm-hmm, though I mm-hmm. don't really,
really
agree with
don't
this.
Want to. I was hoping to not have to be in the room with you two until Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Yeah.
I get it, sir. I understand. You're like, I want my one visit a year and that's it.
Mm-hmm. That's what we got in the tank. That's what we got.
Anything else really messes with your life. He gets off the phone, and Ford's dad is suddenly bombarded with Ford's younger brother,
mm-hmm.
Ben.
Ben!
Who's like, gee, Dad, thanks for the vote of confidence.
You could run off to the son you like instead.
God. And he's like, you know, just give me 24 hours, and I could, like, have this all handled.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, no, you're not allowed to do anything until the son I like better's here.
He doesn't quite use those words. But
basically.
Benjamin Ford here is played by T.E. Russell, who would go on to be one of the stars of Fame L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Also a leading role on the medical drama City of Angels, which ran for one season. Also starring Viola Davis.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I don't know if I've ever heard of that. Because I immediately went to first the musical and then the Nicolas Cage movie.
Neither of those.
And I didn't know there was a TV show, too.
It's a popular name for things.
It is.
Unrelated things in three mediums.
I bet I go in the exact wrong order compared to everyone else in the world. because I always assume the musical, and that is pretty much the end of everyone else's list.
You are some gumshoe, you just don't think well. Get this, dumb gumshoe, you come from my inkwell.
Yeah.
Is your mouth lonely with one foot in there? Stone, your brain only holds thoughts I put in there.
I love that you still remember the... that musical.
The Act One finale is a great song.
I don't remember things from it that well. I know a few of them if we listen to the soundtrack, but like, so.
You're nothing without me. Without me, you just disappear right into thin air. No one would care or notice you ever were here.
So for listeners at home, Grant and I met doing community theater musicals.
Uh-huh.
We were in a production of Oliver. It's when he asked me to prom a year in advance.
Exactly a year in advance.
It was very, very... this was 20 years ago, actually. We just celebrated our 20-year anniversary of being together, and that happened while we were in Oliver. Now, we were in one more musical together, and uh-huh. that was City of Angels. The most cursed production... in Southeast Michigan.
I love the one night where they didn't play the sound effect of the shooting. So the one lady just collapsed. Like, fuck it. I'm falling down. Do the rest of the scene.
So this musical, which has great music, highly suggest checking it out.
It's a Cy Coleman joint. Good stuff.
It is supposed to, like, be done in kind of two realities.
It is the story of a pulp novelist going to Hollywood and adapting one of his works for the screen and getting to know the business and the people and caught up in, you know, like, stuff with his ex-wife, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, in parallel, the story of the movie is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, and in its premiere, that whole story is done entirely in black and white, costume and prop sets.
Yes. So where things first go wrong? That means you have to make two entire sets and have two entire sets of costumes for everyone.
Yes, because everyone but the two principals is doing a dual role.
Yes.
Right? The mob boss in the detective story is played by the same actor as the studio boss in the Hollywood story.
Yes. And there are times where, like, things are happening at the same time. It's very complicated. They never finished the sets. First problem right there, okay? There wasn't enough time. They were like... please come to the theater and help paint stuff until 4 a.m. if you can for the next four nights.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did not finish the sets in time, okay? The next thing that happened is one of the main actors who was playing one of the lead roles got sick to the point where, like, he was put on vocal rest and was not allowed to sing or he might, like, permanently damage his voice.
Yes.
So then they had to get... they had to bring up a different guy from a different role to become him.
Mm-hmm.
But that meant there was now an open spot. And then again, so many people are on stage, you can only double up people so many times. So they took the orchestra drummer to be that actor when the other guy was up, who did the show with a script in hand because he couldn't learn all the lines in time. And then the director would go be the drummer for some numbers.
He also had a walk-on role or two of his own because the cast was so much bigger than the number of people we had by the end.
And also people were dropping like flies.
Yeah. I like that every show the slit in your dress got a little higher.
My dress just kept ripping.
Because other people's repairs were, like, higher on the priority list than yours.
Yes, I had one line in this show and, like, 12 costume changes. I didn't matter. But I was 17, and, like, that was up to my, like, navel by the end of the show.
Hell yeah, brother. It's my favorite show.
I look damn good in that dress. Oh, man, this show. It everything that could go wrong, like, went fucking wrong in this show. It was pure chaos. How no one actually, like, died or got hurt, I do not know. Oliver's the show that actually had, like, hospital visits for people. But City of Angels, just, like, everything was breaking. Everything was ripping. Everyone was suddenly, like, rotating, like, which part they were playing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was just waiting for them to be like, Elena, you go drum. And I'm like, I don't know how, but okay. Like, it's a really great musical, though. You should go listen to it.
Yeah, the tennis song. You want innuendo. You're going to get them.
Yeah, yeah. You had fun.
I sang no songs.
Speaking of characters who like their hot mom.
I am but a 17-year-old babo, and I am really getting all up on the legs of this, like, what, 30-year-old woman?
Oh, she was not 30. She was definitely, like, 49.
So, yeah, Viola Davis was in a TV drama of the same title and otherwise unrelated.
Uh-huh, yeah.
With the guy that played Ben Ford.
Yeah, so, moving on. Lucas and Bridger are having a little chat about how the ice caps are melting.
Yes, all this industrial action, not just the mining, but also the agriculture, is, like, churning up a lot of activity and causing hot water to slide under the cold water. And we are in the South Atlantic, so we're worried about the Antarctic ice caps.
Mm-hmm.
And as Lucas is arguing for, you know, the duty for environmental protection, Ford walks in and says, "That's the price of progress, Lucas."
And they write your paycheck.
It's all approved by the UEO, and come on. It must be good if the government says it's okay.
Which is the most un-Ford thing to say. I hate that line.
Or is it the most Ford thing to say? Like he's not an environmental crusader. He's a believer in regulations. If it goes through the whole process, he believes in process.
I don't know. I feel like Ford wouldn't just, like, blanket, though. He's like, yes, there, you know, he would acknowledge that there are problems, but at the same time, it is sanctioned. So, like, our hands are tied.
Right. You'd like him to be a little more reluctant in this moment.
You know, this is in the hands of the legislator.
Right.
Or something like that type thing.
Write your ocean congressman.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That is what Ford would direct. But anyways, he asks for a couple days off. The only person that he has confided in about his family is Bridger. Because Bridger's like, is this about your dad? And he's like, yeah.
Well, that secure link showed up on a lot of other screens around the boat, too.
Ortiz is so bad about being O'Neill. He's so bad. He fucked up. Everyone got to listen to their conversation. It was, like, broadcast out, like, by the whiskers to, like, Cuba. Everyone back, like, home knows.
Well, yeah. Ortiz wanted his family to see how good he is at forwarding calls.
Yeah. He's like, I'm training in as a communication officer today, yeah, Grandma. Yeah. Look at this.
But yes.
He felt bad for those relatives he has on ice.
Mm-hmm,
he, like, sent that. They have, like, a little...
Is the agriculture melting them, too?
Good question.
Yeah, where are they stored? You got to check up on that.
Yeah. Oh, is Brody worried about his mom?
Everyone's worried about Brody's mom. But yes, Ford's permission is granted to take leave for family business. Emphasis on business.
Ford has gotten himself ready to leave. He's in his casual clothes, which much more fashionable than when he went in to the beach.
Yeah, but it definitely comes out of the same wardrobe, right?
He bought a leather vest.
He did.
He's wearing a leather vest. His shirt is untucked. Ford has learned how to be cooler, how to betray the cool guy. I will say
he's been hanging out with Tony Piccolo.
I think between Tony and Brody, he has picked up some fashion tips.
And Ortiz, you know, cruising for babes
and
on that
Ortiz.
Boat.
And Ortiz. I feel like his time with the boys they're the fashion boys.
The fashion
boys. We got
boys.
The paella boys, now we got the fashion boys. And they've been like, dude, you need to untuck. It's not cool to tuck.
Happy Pride, everybody.
Yeah. The leather vest was probably on one of their escapades. He brought it, actually. And he's like, does this make me look cool? And they're like, yes. Get the vest.
So as he's gathering his things, as he's heading out, he runs into Dagwood.
Who's mopping the grating.
Yes.
Like normal.
With his incredible soap mop. I love the soap mop.
I love the soap mop because it just makes me think of like the little dish scrubber things with the soap in the handle, but they just enlarged it.
Corn dog in hand. Again, I remind you.
Still has the corn dog.
And this is the conversation where Ford, who has a difficult family, a strained family, has to explain that to Dagwood, who has no personal connection to family, you know, nuclear family, birth family.
He's an uncle.
He is an uncle. Yes.
But so he asks where like Ford's going, and Ford says, I have to go visit my family. And that's what triggers this conversation of like, you have to go, like, you don't want to. And he's like, eh, not this time.
I love my family. It's just easier to love them far away.
I get this.
Yes. Yes.
Ford, my man. I understand.
This is a perspective that is new to Dagwood. He has to puzzle it out. And there is a metaphor about how, you know how like when you go to a restaurant, you're nicer? This is the utopian future of the UEO.
It is.
Where everyone is assumed to be especially kind to their waitstaff.
Yes. Or Ford's just delusional because he is, and he thinks everyone is. But, like, Ford, that's not the reality, unfortunately.
They've abolished the tipped minimum wage in the UEO future, but he still tips 22% all the same as a base.
He is such a good customer. It's why bartenders are happy to just give him, like, lime water as much as he wants.
It's all he orders.
Because even if he doesn't pay, like, isn't being charged for, like, a water, he's going to tip 22% on, like, what he thinks drinks would have cost.
Yes, yes.
He's like, yes, my lime water would have cost $8. I will tip on that. Yeah, they have their little convo, and
it ends with Dagwood piecing together all of these illustrations and metaphors and turns of phrase into a Frankenstein sentence about driving your family to a town called Distraction, where you go have a nice meal at a restaurant.
Yes.
And then he smiles because, yep, I get it. I get what family is now.
And Ford's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Gonna get on this maglev now. Okay.
No one's going to mention the corn dog.
And so Ford goes to meet his brother and this dude, Polly, at the same bar that Brody picked up his mom.
I'm pretty sure, right?
It is absolutely the same location, right? It is absolutely the same bar.
It's filmed from a different angle, so you get different like skyline behind it. But it's the same outdoor patio pier bar.
And so his brother Ben is drinking with this guy Polly, who also works at the place.
And Polly's so happy to see Ford.
Yes. Ford orders an iced tea, of course. He's like, can I get an iced tea over here?
He's living wild.
With a lemon?
He's on vacation. He's getting iced tea.
Maybe a sugar packet? Gonna have some extra calories tonight.
I call it the Short Island iced tea. It's just iced tea.
Oh, Ford, I love you, don't change. But
Ben is sick of how much, like, Polly loves Ford.
Yeah, he's so like, oh, you're fucking fired, I hate you. You're supposed to like me more than my brother, I worry, your paychecks.
Like, come on, he hasn't seen him for a while. And, like, they have this, like, natural chemistry they fall into. Ford and Polly are buds, and Ben's like, everybody loves my brother, I'm here, I'm doing work.
So of course he does the whole like, oh, he can't stay, he was just leaving.
Yeah, he's got the night shift out in the kelp fields.
And Ford's like, we never do night shifts, what are you talking about? Well, you haven't been here.
Yeah,
you don't know what we're doing.
We're being unfair to Ben
since you've been gone. I can breathe for the first time! Yeah.
I love you so much.
You too. 20 years. This is what 20 years does. And so, of course, Ford's like, well, it wasn't my idea. I didn't want to be here. Mm-hmm, like, Dad made me.
And Ford tries to extend an olive branch. He knows that his brother is testy. He knows his brother is testy mostly because of their imbalanced relationship with their dad. And he's like, hey, I'm sorry. We could try to, you know, do some stuff. And, like, Ben, very logically, while very prickly, says, who cares if we get along if we never see each other? Mm-hmm. If you're not around, what's there to fix? No skin off my nose.
Yeah.
It's like, damn, all right. It's like that. Okay.
He's like, I do a good job. I make good decisions when I'm allowed to.
Again, we're hearing directly without Daddy Ford in the room. Just like, can we get Dad to let me do the job that I have, please?
I am the COO.
Can I operate some things chiefly, please?
And you know what? Here's the deal, is all the staff that works for them would also like him to do the job, because they're over there like, why is he getting the paycheck if he doesn't do bullshit?
Now, one thing against Ben is he really only makes one decision. He has one big plan in this episode. We're about to see what it is.
Yeah.
It's very bad.
It's very bad. It's incredibly
bad and stupid.
It's pretty bad to go from I make good decisions like, when I'm allowed to, which here's the deal. He's not allowed to technically here. So maybe that's why it's bad.
Because of the law. Because this thing is very, very illegal.
Yeah. And okay. Like, well, and he, I mean, his dad's was like, don't make any decisions until Ford's here.
Hey,
and
Ford's
he made,
here.
He made decision, this was decided before Ford was here.
That's true.
Hence why it's a bad decision.
Okay.
I feel like there's a thing here.
Okay. I mean, he makes a second decision that saves the day. Mm-hmm. But that is not a business related, that is an action scene related decision. That is a different sphere of action.
Yeah. So anyways, what decision he made was to send Polly out on the boat to the rig for sea mine, and to
in his little dinghy right across the bay,
And to go in a scuba suit and put a bomb on the mine.
Yeah. We're gonna save the company. We're gonna save the fields by blowing up the other interest here that's ruining our kelp forest.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's his great idea.
Sure. With a bomb.
Uh-huh.
So Polly, like, pulls up. He checks the bomb. Then the next shot is in the water looking up at the boat while Polly, like, dives in. And it is suddenly daytime.
Yeah. As soon as he gets in the water, that is the brightest lit water I've ever seen in my life.
Like,
he is so lucky that the moon is shining so brightly and that there's underwater lamps. Apparently.
I understand it is impossible, like 100% impossible to light this scene properly underwater at night. We could do the day for night color grade a little harder. You could help me out a little bit.
This is brighter than when the scuba divers at the beginning, who were scuba diving in the middle of the day, yes, were getting their sand sample.
But still, we are committed to the fiction, because as he, like, swims over to, like, this structural frame submerged at the sea mine location, he turns on the little flashlight strapped to his head.
Yes.
That's doing nothing, man.
And so, yeah, he as he's putting the bomb on, the red monster eye point of view appears.
Oh, no.
And he, dies with a big chomp.
Oh no, the red got him. He got by the red.
So back on the sea quest, Lucas and Bridger are listening to Darwin, who's just yelling about things dying. The sea lions, the dolphins, everyone's dying.
Darwin has his ear to the ground. He's got the hot goss.
Yes.
Darwin's an informant.
And he's like, it's bigger than an orca. And it's eating all the fish and scaring all the dolphins.
And so Lucas says, huh, well, maybe all this temperature shift has moved like a pod of orcas over here. And Bridger's like, didn't you fucking listen? He said bigger than an orca. Orcas are not bigger than orcas. What's wrong with you?
But Darwin is trying to give them more clues. He's like, hey, it's where the warm water comes from the cold water, but it's now warm.
Mm-hmm. The ice is getting warm.
Mm-hmm. So that's where this is happening. Mm-hmm. It's near land in that freaky fucking water. Not an orca, Lucas.
It's not.
It's not. I said no.
But a pod of orcas is bigger than one orca by definition. Shut up, Lucas. Get out of here. Go hack at it, why don't you, computer boy?
Rude. So
I say nice things about Lucas when he's the A plot.
Yeah.
I get to be mean to Lucas when he's a supporting character.
So mean. So Ford is now with his dad and Ben at the Ford field.
Yeah, it. Ford. Yes, he's playing with the Lions.
Ford Beach. Ford, what was it called?
Ford Freeport.
We're going to call it Ford Field.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
They're at Ford Field.
Their company seems to just be. They don't have offices. They just walk around on that beach all the time.
Let's remember also this. It makes sense to call it Ford Field because in the novelization of Sequest, Ford is from Detroit.
Is he Detroit or is he South Chicago? He's Midwestern.
Detroit's mentioned in something. Is it Detroit?
It's been a long time. And you know what? I'm going to bend to your expertise.
No, actually, he might be Chicago. See, this is where I can be wrong because I've only read the novelization once.
Okay.
I have owned it my whole life, but I only read it once. We could look at it right now. It's right there, and it's really early on. They talk about him.
I don't think there's an index. I don't want to spend the time on that.
Okay,
right
he's
now.
Either from Chicago or Detroit. We're going to go with Ford Field.
Okay.
For talk, because I'm not going to remember whatever the fuck this place was called.
Ford Freeport Agriculture? Yeah. Aquaculture?
So he's there, and his dad's, like, yelling at Ben of, like, Polly's missing! What the fuck did you do? He has a family!
We can't have a company without Polly. Polly was the linchpin. That he is the third employee to die in, like, a day. This is bad.
This is not good. And Ford tries to stick up for his brother a little bit of like, oh, he was just trying to do his job. And he's like, no, I can handle this.
Shut up, John. Don't tell Dad to love me.
But then a call comes in from Rayner. And Rayner's the head dude over at the sea mine place. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, I found something that belongs to your father. And you know what it is? Because he goes over there. It is the boat that Polly had.
It's Polly's little dinghy, all torn up. Oh my goodness.
And they're like, oh man, what could have done this? And Ben starts arguing with Rayner about how, like, you know, who's done what and who's at fault and beefing.
I haven't seen a dinghy this destroyed since I was looking up cognitive behavioral therapy, but I clicked the wrong thing with the acronym.
Okay. Rainer's like, you know, maybe my guys have, like, unloaded some waste a little early, but, like, we've never done sabotage. And you know what? No matter what we've done, it doesn't count for this. And he pulls out the fucking bomb.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'm a polluter destroying the environment, but I'm no murderer, John. Come on, be reasonable.
And he's like, I'm willing to let this go. I'm not gonna call the authorities about the bomb that I found strapped to my business.
How understanding do you have to be to let an attempted bombing slide? Rayner is a chum. He is the most heroic polluter I've ever seen on this show.
And so they're like, okay, sounds good, we'll leave. And they leave, and Ford just rips into Ben.
Yeah,
he's
man.
Like, what the hell are you doing? You're so fucking stupid. And Ben's like, are you gonna tell Dad? And he's like, no, you are. After you tell Polly's mom. That's when you know he's an older brother that means, like, is not taking this shit. You have crossed the line.
You gotta tell Polly's mom.
That you killed him.
Polly's mom, why do you look like you're 23?
You're really hot. Like, no, that's his wife. That's the mom. Oh, the one that looks 15?
She's got Benjamin Button disease.
Ford is so pissed at his brother that he has left him behind, I guess, and gotten in the single seat Stinger.
Well, that's why he left him behind. It's a single seater. Everyone's just taking the Stinger out.
Apparently, they have multiple Stingers. Did he get permission
from Lucas?
They got a single seat Stinger, and they have a multi seat Stinger.
They got
now.
The minivan Stinger.
Yes, they have there's now different sizes.
Okay, what if they just strapped Rawlings on the top last week? And that's how they got him out.
That would have worked.
Yeah. Just put him on the luggage rack.
Hold your breath. And we'll try not to hit the wall. It's fine. So as he's in the Stinger, he does what all good older siblings do, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that's call someone to complain about your younger sibling.
Do you think your brother does this about you all the time?
Probably. I do it about him.
Okay, sure.
So he is talking to his dad. You know, I did what I could with him. He's kind of your problem now. I'm going back home to work.
He tried to play peacemaker. He tried to do something. And then he found out that his brother was doing horrible illegal sabotage things and got Polly killed.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And while they're having this conversation, his dad is looking at the recovered camera that they found from those
back from the cold open. Yeah, yeah.
And in the film, he sees giant jaws.
And he starts to scream. He starts screaming for Jonathan, his son, the good one, to get out of there.
He's like, where are you? You gotta run. And he's like, what are you talking about? I was like, there's something out there. And then there's this like sequence of that Ford gets hit with the monster's like tail.
Yeah,
and his dad sees the tail come out of the water.
Yeah, it's a giant tail breaching the surface.
And he's like, you gotta run to the kelp beds, hide there.
Hide in the kelp.
And Ford sees the monster and is like, holy shit, and like steers towards the kelp beds. And
so last week we talked a lot about them forgetting that the Stinger is a single sea craft.
Mm-hmm.
This week they seem to have forgotten that it goes like 200 miles an hour.
Yes. This is true.
Like, I'm sorry, but no, all Ford has to say is, oh shit, and then he's done. He's there. He's safe.
He leaves. He just goes. But no, he's hiding in a kelp bed, and he's like, that is the biggest alligator I've ever seen. And his dad's like, it's a crocodile. And I'm like,
nothing's ever good enough for you. Never.
You saw its butt. How do you know?
He's really good at tails.
Explains things.
What does that explain? What things?
Gonna get in tail of like, it was, if this was the scenario where like, he was actually coming to meet the stepmother and blah 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 blah, you could make a joke about him chasing tails.
Sure.
Yeah.
But Father Ford has a plan. You see, he knows this whole facility, this whole bay, and he knows that Ford is something like 60 feet from this big pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to turn the valve on this pipe and turn it into a plankton cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is normally used to like feed the aquaculture farm, but instead it's going to be used to attract the gigantic crocodile so Ford can run to the beach in the opposite direction.
So yeah, we got our plankton cannon, and Ford makes his escape.
Yes, and the whole time, big brass horns are blaring as the action theme for this episode.
And so he takes the Stinger to the beach.
Which might be reused footage from the end of season one, I'm not sure. If this is just reusing a clip of Bridger beaching the Stinger at the end.
I didn't notice it enough to catch that.
If they didn't, they should have. It's the economical thing to do.
They might have. So Ford, as soon as he's there, though, radios the Sequest and is like, hey, the situation in the South Atlantic is definitely Sequest business now.
Yeah, we deal with sea monsters. Sea monsters is our thing.
Please come. Help.
So we go to commercial, and on the other side, Ford is with the Stinger in its launch bay, and everyone else is gathered around to just sort of gawk at how fucked up it got.
Yes. I mean, Lucas is looking it over. He's like, you know, this is pretty fucked up, but we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this. This will be okay. And Ford is like, I take back everything I said about paying for that titanium siding. It was the right choice. Great job, Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
You were right all along. I should ask you to be my roommate when I go to the sexual harassment training. What?
He's a popular guy, yeah.
He's like, I'm not taking the sexual harassment training 20 times for y'all to be my roommate. This is becoming sexual harassment.
It's becoming schedule harassment. He's got other things to do with his life.
They're like, no, you don't. It's fine. You don't have a date. What are you talking about?
I'm trying to get some sexual non-harassment over here.
And so then they're having a little chat about this, the crocodile, and Wendy's like, you know, like, they can get to be 30 feet. Are you sure you saw what you saw? Ford is like, absolutely. This is like when I saw the mermaid and none of you believed me.
He insists it's 200 feet. His dad is there and he's like, well, 170, I'd say.
Fuck you, Dad.
It's so good. It's so good.
But Lucas has a theory.
Mm-hmm, of course.
He's like, you know, if it's as big as you think it is, it might be this...
Dinosuchus?
Yes, the Dinosuchus, which sounds made up.
It is an ancient crocodilian reptile from the Cretaceous that Lucas says could get... that big, and perhaps it was frozen in the Antarctic ice and all this activity has thawed it and returned it to the ecosystem. Obviously.
Dinosuchus is the type of name that Tony would make jokes about.
That's why he's not in the room.
No.
That's not true. He is in the room.
But they just don't allow him to.
He's in the deleted scenes. Yeah. Yeah.
There's the whole series of him, like, making jokes off that name.
And then he has to go to the sexual harassment seminar.
Yes, and he's like, damn it. And Lucas can't be my roommate right now because of the Dinosuchus. But Tony's one line in this is him freaking out about the Dinosuchus being out there where he's swimming.
Because
he's like, well, no, I'm going to get eaten.
We learn a lot about our enemy here. Number one, Lucas floats the idea, who says there's only one?
There could be many.
You know, we've seen one at a time. That doesn't mean much at the end of the day. Tony finds a chunk of its skin in the torn breech of the stinger's hull and sniffs it. He sniffs it.
I mean, if there's something as old as that, you'd probably be curious about how it smells. It might just be smelly. Yeah.
It probably smells like the ocean.
Well, he smells that a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. So anyways, they, later on the Sequest, they send out the Roomba.
Yes, the radio frisbee, the scattercom.
It looks like a Roomba with lights.
It's back from the fear that follows.
It's out looking for data about if there's, like, more of these. And
not just looking for those, but looking for anything moving across the ocean floor.
Yes.
So we go to Bridger's wood-paneled room, where he and Dr. Smith and Lucas are looking at all of the sea life that they can find and all of their instruments.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not seeing another one, so that's good.
They aren't seeing much of anything, because it's hungry.
And so we start to have the conversation of, like, well, if we find it, what are we going to do? And Ford is like, you know, this is going to really hurt, like, the ecosystem and the, you know, the fishing and this and that. And Lucas is like, we cannot kill it.
This is
like a major discovery.
This is a one-of-a-kind creature. Jurassic Park is happening, and we need Jurassic Park 2 to start, where they just send scientists to poke at it.
Yes. But they're like, you know, we're lucky that this hasn't destroyed a village yet. There's so much that could happen from this. And so Bridger's like, well, what we gotta start with is we gotta evacuate the human population, because we gotta at least protect the people. And Ford's dad is like, okay, cool, but you mean, like, the people who don't work for me, right?
just the local villagers, right? Right? You're not putting me out of business, right? And Bridger's like, we are putting you out of business.
But you're not OSHA. This is fine. He's like, no, everyone, all of you, you're out. And his dad says something about how, like, well, fine, but good luck telling the bank I'm defaulting on my loans because of a 200-foot crocodile. And Ford's like, well, 170. So good.
Fuck you, Dad.
Fuck you, Dad.
So now it's 200 feet, huh?
He does his, like, charming smile. Love it.
I love that, you know, with his career, with his years apart, like, someone who is raised by Ford's dad, you can imagine going right back to old patterns, you know, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. But like, he's built the confidence to make the point of, oh, so now it's 200 feet, but make it by just like being snide and clever like that with his charming little smile.
Yes.
It's good. It's so good.
It's good. So the evacuation's happening and they're on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Ortiz has got his guns out. Ford's got the guns out.
Ortiz must love it when he can wear one of his cool hats while on duty.
Yes. Yeah. He loves pulling out the cool hats. He's got a beret today.
He's got the military beret. Not quite his Kangol hat, but, you know, it's in the family.
Yeah.
But, and if it's any consolation, this has got to be shutting Sea Mine down too, right? Come on.
Yeah.
It's the same bay. They got to go. We never check in on them again.
So Ortiz, though, is like, hey, Ford, how rich are you? And Ford's like, that's kind of rude. Well, if you're this fucking rich, why are you still working? And Ford just looks at him, and it's like, so I can order guys like you around.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously.
Love you, Ford. I love now, Jonathan Ford.
Go fucking do your job.
So yes, they're loading up trucks with crates, they're loading up trucks with villagers, everyone's heading out, and Ford sees his father standing on the beach that is their office. I don't think there's a roof company.
There was a tent. There was a large tent.
And he's looking off in the distance in the sea, and he walks up and thinks that his dad is mulling over the huge loss in his investment and what this means for the global operation and how do you insure against UEO evacuation.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, don't worry, you'll be back soon. It will only take a couple weeks. And he's like, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking about how I came very close to losing you.
Yes, he's worried about his son dying, not his company going in the red.
Which is very sweet, but I'm also over here like, do you know what your son does for a job?
He's usually on the big boat. The problem is it's a little boat. He needs to be on the big boat.
This, like, also doesn't, like, even hit, like, top scariest situations Ford has been in. This is, like, pretty mediocre.
He was tortured by Charlton Heston.
Yes. And his dad knows none of this because he goes home for, like, Thanksgiving and that's it. He doesn't do Christmas because Christmas he goes and sees the Nutcracker by himself.
He did a Die Hard. And it was...
He did fucking Die Hard. It was fucking amazing. His dad has no idea.
He did have his body taken over by an alien at one point.
Yes. Yes, he did. His dad also doesn't know about that. Nope.
One knows about that. That one's classified. You can't talk about that one.
Yeah.
No.
His dad has no idea about when he was, like, in the eye of a hurricane on a dinghy.
Uh-huh.
And, like, got swept overboard and almost died if it wasn't for a rope. No idea.
A rope and a precocious child.
Yes. Only Daddy Ford knew.
Mm-hmm.
Only he knew.
But it is time for the family to heal.
Yes, because Ford is like, well, don't worry about it. You would still have Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And Papa Ford looks kind of at Ben. He's like, so I take it this is your way of telling me to stop being a jerk to your brother.
Now, this is the first time Ben has appeared on screen since they found the bomb.
Yes.
Ben kind of disappears for like an act and a half of this episode.
Is he in the background when they're on the Sequest? Or no?
I don't know if he... Like when they're around the Stinger, I don't think he is there.
Ford that's there.
Yeah.
But Ford is like, oh, I would never tell you what to do. And he's like, so I take it this is also your way of telling me to stop being a jerk to you. Then his dad starts like laughing and he's like, oh, what's so funny? And he's like, well, it's just funny that you're coming here to keep me going and now you're shutting me down. But let's get going. Let's go to your brother. It's all good. We're chummy.
So then it's Ford's turn to speak with his brother Ben one-on-one a little bit. And they both share how I owe you an apology. No, you don't. Wait, what's this one for? That's how the conversation starts.
Yes.
And
while they're having this conversation, Daddy Ford gets distracted by some really large drag lines in the sand that, like, no one else apparently noticed.
What's that big gouge track running up the beach? I'm going to follow it. Me, the judge from A Few Good Men.
And of course, we have to have some monster vision happening from far away, seeing Daddy Ford follow this trail. But the boys don't know this because they're having their heart-to-heart, where we find out that, you know, Ford starts to apologize, like, hey, sorry, I didn't stick around and you had to, like, you know, take over the family business. And he's like, I didn't stick around because I had to. I stuck around because I actually like this. I like this work.
I like aquaculture. I'm into farms. Ocean farms.
And Ford's like, did you ever tell Dad? He thinks you hate this. And he's like, you think I'm crazy? I've never told that man anything true in my life. But then, as Ford is loading crates, Ben notices his dad, like, wandering off up the sand. And he's like, what's going on? And then he notices, like, the tail of the crocodile. And without being like, oh my God, Ford, it's the giant crocodile, he just runs away.
Yes. Yes.
Not saying anything.
And they find that big, big boy in a field because lizards love golf.
Yes.
Yes, they do.
Papa Ford has gone up there, and now the crocodile is like, hey, I got you trapped. But then Ben has to swoop in to be like, oh my God, Dad. And he's like, I'm going to be the hero. And so Ben, like, runs trying to, like, get the crocodile to follow him
to
save his dad.
He's doing jumping jacks. He's doing anything he can to get this ancient crocodile's attention, and it works. And he leads it on a merry chase until he slips and falls down a dune. And we are seeing this from... the other Fords' points of view.
Yes, because Ford has joined as well.
So they look up and it looks like he's pinned. It looks like the gator got him. And as they climb the hill to see what they expect to be their brother/son's corpse, I guess.
Yeah, after a good chomp.
They actually see him lying intact upon a bed of gigantic eggs.
Ooh.
Oh.
Now I feel like we should pause and talk about the CGI of this crocodile.
Yeah?
It's so cute.
It's adorable.
It's so fucking cute.
It's perfectly good. It moves well. The texture is good. The composition into the location filming is good. Like
from a perspective now, obviously, 30 years later, we're working with very different CGI.
Yeah.
But it is, like... very good for the time.
Yeah. You're telling me a team made this in 10 days in 1995?
With that many teeth?
Yes.
And scales? Like, they weren't even doing, like, hair at Pixar yet.
I mean, the nearest thing of its era is, like, the fish in the submarine scene in episode 1. Which had... all of Industrial Light and Magic, the industry leader.
And a giant budget.
Comparatively, to be sure. And a whole lot more than 10 days, I'll say.
Yeah. But it's cute.
He's a cutie pie. Now, the thing I thought you were going to bring up is that first POV shot sure looks like the gator is in the surf behind Daddy Ford.
It was.
But then... it gets to the field before, and no one watches it go.
No, so the reason Ben goes running because he sees the tail.
Okay. In the shot.
So it's like we see it's
because it's
at
so gigantic, it has a big stride, so it gets there really, really fast. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the thing is that it probably, because it's large, can climb up a different more direct path than the footpath they have to take that probably winds a bit more, right?
Okay.
I'm thinking that. So I'm thinking, like, what probably happened? His dad started up the dune into the trees and whatnot. Gator goes up faster spot. Ben has to go up the roundabout foot trail that, you know, it's not direct. It's going to curve around and shit.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Okay.
Yeah. It makes sense.
It makes sense.
It does.
So, I really thought that shot was setting up that there are indeed two of them. Lucas's fears are correct. Mm-hmm. The next thing we learn is, no, there's just one. There's just the one. We have absolutely determined that. We've also determined there's, like, no fish left in this part of the ocean.
Yeah, so we're back on the sea quest. Fish are missing. There's none around. It's pretty dead out there. Pop Ford is like, Ben, that was so stupid. I told you not to run, and you ran. Why'd you do that? And
also, like, why didn't you let it kill me so I'd be out of your way like you want, idiot? Come on.
He's like, I don't want you out of my life. I just want you out of my way so I can, like, have a job. And so then
and they have
hug.
A big hug. I love making wet farms.
And then Dagwood sees this and is like, oh my gosh, Ford doesn't like his family. I must hug him too. I will be his family.
And of course, nearly crushes him. And this is the only scene where he does not have the corn dog.
Yeah.
The corn dog is somewhere.
Yes.
What happened?
And I love the end of this because, like, at West Ford is, like, trying to breathe and it's like, oh my god, Dagwood, let me. And finally, like, gets to let go and gives him a, like, a little tap, like, thanks. Dagwood's like, welcome. And just, like, walks away.
Mr. DeLuise, amazing. He's, like.
Sometimes his timing is so good.
It's so good. His timing, his tone, like, he built this character and turned it into something likable and compelling, and it's all in his posture and this unusual vocal choices he makes. Oh, it's good.
Sometimes they do the absolute worst shit with it, but there's these moments that he just sells that are just so good, and it's like, it's why you have affection for the character.
Mm-hmm. I saw recently The Worst Thing in the World, which is, okay, you know how people will use generative AI video things to make trailers for things that don't exist?
Yeah.
Sequest Reboot. It was so ugly, it's garbage, it's heinous. But the reason I bring it up is because, of course, it made casting choices.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to guess who Lucas was? I bet you can.
Did they actually still have Jonathan Brandis because they didn't know he died?
No, Chalamet.
Timothée Chalamet?
Yes.
Here's the deal. If they were ever to reboot, you can't touch the character! You can't touch him!
but I bring this up for another casting choice. For Dagwood, Dave Bautista. The face you made is I would say, an understatement. Because the thing about Dagwood is, now, before I go on, I love the acting work of Mr. Dave Bautista. I think he's incredibly talented. I love him. The first, like, 10 minutes of Blade Runner 2049, the best thing that's ever been in the Blade Runner franchise, frankly. But
we're not going to do this character in 2025? First that, maybe?
Maybe. But the thing that makes Dagwood work as well as it does is he is soft, but is surprisingly strong.
Yes.
Whereas Bautista, with his physicality, with his history, with his energy, he can do the opposite very, very well.
Yeah.
He's clearly strong, but surprisingly soft. But that's a different thing. That is the opposite thing.
Yeah.
It's entirely wrong.
It's not it. Oh, man. Yeah, if a Whiskers listener made that, I'm judging you.
Burn your home. Walk into the ocean.
You need to, like, do penance and, like,
the ocean, you are boiling and therefore releasing ancient sea monsters. Yeah, think about it.
Don't use fucking AI. Let's just first pause on that. If you're a Whiskers listener and you use AI, stop being a Whiskers listener. We don't want you here. Jesus fucking Christ.
You have let your brain be colonized by garbage with the promise that it will bring you something. No, you are giving away.
Just don't use AI.
Just don't do it.
It's, you do not need to. I'm so sick of it.
So Ford has a few bruised ribs after this.
Yes. Ortiz, though, interrupts because there is a plane that has spotted the croc. She is sunning herself on the sand.
Even ancient sea monsters enjoy a nice day at the beach.
Yes. But Wendy has been doing science, because we occasionally do science, on that skin, and she has learned.
They've been hearing our notes.
Yes.
They're getting back to it as the season goes.
She still looks like a school teacher. The croc is 3.5 years old.
Uh-huh.
Lucas is like, oh my god, its life expectancy is like 120.
And they lay several clutches of eggs per year.
And Wendy's like, it's okay, she's sterile.
Yeah.
Like, it's not gonna be a problem.
I love that we get, like, 3 seconds of tension thinking about a whole species being propagated.
Yeah.
Before, no, never mind, that's not a problem, don't worry about it.
But then we are back to the original problem of it's gonna wreak havoc on the food chain. And so they all have to sit with that for a second. But then Dagwood, with his corn dog,
comes in. The dogs are back in town. Wow.
We cannot kill her. We need to put her back where we got her. As he looks at the corn dog.
There's the setup and the payoff. It's a long, long thread running.
Put that thing back where it came from. So help me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Do you think that is what they're going to put in the Muppet Vision Theater?
Oh.
They're going to do a live performance of Put That Thing Back Where It Came From or So Help Me the Musical?
It would be the only acceptable choice. If it is not that... I mean, first off, there's... Closing Muppets is just... It's the most awful thing in the world.
Jail for 10,000 years.
Yes. Like, you better be announcing to me that we are opening it when... Eventually, on the other side of the park. But if that's what they do, if they do that, that'd be pretty great.
I would accept the place where Captain EO used to be in Epcot. That'd be a good place for it.
Oh, that'd be good too.
They're just doing Pixar shorts there over the last 15 years or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They could also just, like, build a theater over by Rock and Roller Coaster, and then, it could be the little Muppet section.
It can be Muppet Courtyard 2 over there. Yeah,
and you know what? You could bring back Pizza Rizzo, but have, like, better pizza. But
have better pizza. Have the nicer flatbread instead of the robot pizza.
If everyone says your pizza is shit, you can just, like, make the pizza better. You're allowed. That's you can correct things. Doesn't have to just state shit.
But everyone looks at Dagwood and they say, well, we can't put it back in the Cretaceous, until Bridger says, wait a minute, it's not from the Cretaceous, it's from the ice flow.
And they're like, oh, we could, like, take it back there. And Lucas is like, we totally have enough liquid nitrogen on this boat
to freeze it,
apparently.
And so, with the plan decided, and everything going back where it belongs, Dagwood decides to put the corn dog in his front pocket.
Like a little boutonniere.
Nice. There's a little slot for a pen, a little narrow thing in his pocket. He slides the corn dog stick in there.
That's where he's been carrying it around all along. It is so smelly.
You think... They had to have had, like, a 10-minute production meeting where they tried to figure out what to do with the corn dog during the hug so it wouldn't be destroyed. And they're just like, okay, he doesn't have it during the hug scene. We'll just hope no one notices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He put it in his, like, corn dog vase.
So
their plan, though, for freezing it is we have to get it off the island. So how better to do that than to send Darwin out as bait?
It ate all of the ocean life. So it must still be hungry. Darwin is bait. For tonight's performance, the role of Darwin will be played by stock footage.
Yes.
Jumping and breaching to, like, basically the same as Ben Ford.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have a whole montage of Darwin doing all that and the crocodile chasing it and almost chomping it and dramatic music.
Yeah, Bridger is like biting his fingernails really on the edge of his seat. Darwin's really hot-dogging around that giant predator that destroyed the entire ecosystem.
Yes.
And ate dozens of other dolphins just like him.
Well, remember, Darwin is famous shark hunter.
It's true.
Darwin has no fear.
He's just that good. He's just plain better than all other dolphins.
Darwin gonna fuck up this croc. And you know what? He does, because he leads it, and then they launch like a liquid nitrogen torpedo at it, I guess, mm-hmm. which puts it to sleep. And so then they grab it with some like ropey grappling hook thing, mm-hmm. and they take it to the ice floe and they drop it and it hits the bottom of the ocean floor, and then they blow up the ice cap to like bury it
in big chunks of ice.
Yeah.
You know how when a small chunk of ice gets knocked off a big chunk of ice, it sinks?
Yeah.
You know how that happens?
I am questioning their plan here of how this works and how this is going to, like, permanently work for a while.
But anyway.
Especially if the ocean water is, like, rising in temperature.
But anyway, this whole ending plan is where the end of Shin Godzilla came from. That's where they got the idea.
Clearly.
So, the Antarctic ice floes that they collapse onto it. More stock footage,
mm-hmm.
which it's good. It looks good.
So now that they've taken care of that, they go back to the beach where they're like burying the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And Ford's like, yeah, it might be kind of smelly for a while, but once they rot, those minerals are going to be great for the soil. Mm-hmm. It's fine. This is when his father announces that he is going to go to Nepal to just check it out.
Maybe they should keep the eggs for, like, science reasons.
I feel like they could do science on the eggs. They could
do science on the eggs.
Maybe they're worried about crocodile DNA.
There are so many paleontologists who are just screaming, no, please, give me the eggs.
But no, we just cover them with sand and say, it's fine.
We could learn so much about Cretaceous crocodilians. Please.
Nah, it's fertilizer now. It's fine. But yeah, Nepal.
Nepal, because he's taking a year off. He's taking a great big vacation. It's Ben's show. So many companies are getting mysterious bombs.
Not even going to talk about that again. And like, oh, this is great. Okay. And so as Ford is leaving to go back to the Sequest, there are some children playing soccer and mm-hmm. a ball gets thrown his way. And so he tosses it back and they chase after the ball and they get it. And then the camera pans and there are more eggs and one of them shakes.
Yes. There's a wiggly one.
Which means they're not all sterile. The end.
In 3.5 years, there's going to be another one between 170 and 200 feet long.
Yes. That's the end.
That is the end, except...
Fish fact!
Rosalind Allen is at SeaWorld Orlando telling us the difference between dolphins and porpoises. Several differences between dolphins and porpoises. The shape of their teeth, the shape of their snout, some behavioral things. No porpoises are shown in this segment. No. We're only looking at dolphins because that's what SeaWorld's got.
Yes. So, darling... Do you have a fish fact?
Of course I have a fish fact. And of course I looked up some actual facts about Deinosuchus.
Oh.
Deinosuchus is estimated to grow up to 35 feet in length, which does make them the largest crocodilian ever known to science, but far from the 170 to 200 feet shown here.
Yeah.
They reach that maximum size after approximately 35 years of growth.
Oh.
In a lifespan that is an estimated 50 plus years, not 120.
Everyone's got their facts wrong.
It is assumed that they laid a single clutch of eggs per year, like modern crocodiles. They preferred to live and hunt in estuary environments, you know, where the river meets the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to start singing the Emmett Otter song, or are we just going to try to...
Do you want to? Do you know the words?
No, but if we ever start talking about barbecue, I got that one on lock.
Okay.
So, but anyhow, this one preying on this coastal aquaculture makes sense, I suppose, from that point of view. Their fossils have been found in Appalachia, and it is therefore theorized that they are the reason why that region had no large theropods. Mm. That is your T-Rex-style body plan, yeah. those species. Because Deinosuchus would have filled that ecological niche, massive predator.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there are some, well, reptile facts.
Okay.
Have you got a fish fact for me, dear?
No, but I got corn dog facts for you.
Hell yeah!
So, in 1927, a U.S. patent was filed, and granted in 1929, for a combined dippin', cookin', and article holdin' apparatus.
Wow.
That describes corn dogs and other fried foods impaled on a stick.
So corn dogs pre-existed this patent to be mentioned in the patent?
Yes.
Okay.
Corn dogs probably originated, like, as just, you know, fried dough around a sausage type thing.
Sure.
Without a stick. Rumored German immigrants, but yeah, you know how things get.
They were the people making the most advances in sausage technology in America.
Yes. But that was, you know, some documentation of corn dogs existing. There's a whole description of these people talking about how this apparatus can help with frying things.
Mm-hmm.
There are a bunch of people, of course, a bunch of businesses and restaurants that have tried to claim the fame of the corn dog.
Of course.
Krusty corn dog baker machine appeared in 1926 in a wholesale catalog for hotels and restaurants.
Mm.
And then vendors claiming responsibility for either inventing or popularizing it, such as Carl and Neil Fletcher laim claim to having introduced their corny dogs at the Ooh. State Fair of Texas sometime between 1938 and 1942.
How corny are they?
Pronto Pup of Pronto Rockaway Pup. Beach, Oregon, claims to have invented the corn dog in 1939.
I feel like Pronto Pup was a crossover between the superhero and funny animal genres. Maybe MLJ Comics got in on Pronto Pup.
Cozy Dog Drive-In in Springfield, Illinois.
Hey!
Claims to have been the first to serve corn dogs on sticks in 1946.
Okay, but that patent was 20 years earlier with, like, an impaling apparatus.
Uh-huh.
They're liars. Get out of here.
But the patent talks about like how this thing could be used for wieners or ham or eggs or fruit or bananas or figs, etc. You peel it on a stick and then you dip it in batter and then you fry it. And like, yeah, it's a corn dog. But But then, also in 1946...
They've already got the horseshoe sandwich. It's wonderful. You don't need to claim the corn dog.
Just get the half size. Don't get the big size. Too much.
It's too much.
Too much. Get the whatever half they got. Also in 1946, Dave Barraham opened the first of hot dog on a stick at Muscle Beach in Santa Monica, California.
With the big hat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big famous hat.
So everyone invented corn dogs. Everyone did it. Everyone put a stick in it.
Sure.
Who the fuck knows? They're good.
They're good.
They're good, and that's what matters.
Watching this episode made me want a corn dog.
I know!
Watching this episode made me remember a time I could have had a corn dog recently and failed to.
I know.
With regret in my heart.
I know. I'm sad. I'm like, damn, should have gotten those corn dogs.
We will find corn dogs.
We can find...
They're in the grocery store. It's not like it's hard to get a corn dog.
Also, we are surrounded by the world of Italian beefs and hot dogs and shit. So I feel like it can't be hard to find a corn dog around here. If I type best corn dog.
Yes.
Chicago.
Yes. Give me Chicago's best corn dog.
Okay, we're getting a lot of the like Asian inspired ones.
Oh yes, the new wave in corn dog technology.
Yes,
there is a fish fact.
Ooh, look at this. That looks pretty good.
Oh, where on Milwaukee? It's a long street.
It's not that far away.
Okay.
I think it's in the shopping center behind the Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes.
We've never been there.
Chicago's Doghouse naturally does a corn dog. Okay.
The Superdog doesn't Super have a corn dog. They just have a hot dog.
Dude, you're lying to me. There's no corn dog at Superdog.
Let's go to... Is there a list of best corn dogs in Chicago? Oh, okay. So this one isn't too far away.
Okay, so yeah. Saddle
Person's got a favorite corn dog there. But yeah, there you go.
There you go.
See, History Honey's people should come listen to this. They get little snippets.
We're teaching the corn dog controversy. The controversy.
Yeah.
So thanks everyone for joining us yet again, as we continue in our journey beneath the waves. Fun thing next time, the first Sequest episode to be written or co-written by a cast member.
Oh!
Yeah. Place your bets on which one.
I know. I can't bet. It'd be cheating. So if you've enjoyed listening to us this week,
and I'm sure you have,
you should definitely go give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to us. It is an opportunity to also tell us, about your favorite Chicago corn dog,
mm-hmm.
or
as mentioned at the top of the episode, your favorite evil little gay boy who makes problems on purpose for fun.
Gimme.
Yeah.
Let's go. It's also okay just to say Char.
It's okay to say Char as in Mold the Red Comet.
It's okay. You can say it. And I'll be like, you know what? You're right. Love that boy. So anyways, do that. And then you can also tell your friends.
Uh-huh.
Word of mouth is great.
It's what mouths were made to do, frankly. But the last thing we're going to ask is, hey, why don't you follow us on Blue Sky? That's WSKRS.bisky.social, where you're going to get all your Whiskers news and updates. You're going to really find a network of people who like thinking about Sequest once in a while. I think, like with the review we read last episode, I think we're starting to build kind of a community.
Yeah.
Like... if you're enjoying the show and you're following the account, just like click any of those posts and see who likes a lot of the account and see what they're up to, you know?
Yeah.
Make some Sequest friends that way.
Make some friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, do all those things. That'd be great.
I suppose that is all we have for you today. So with that,
I'm Elena.
I'm Grant. And in the words of Captain Nathan Bridger,
from beneath the surface lies the future.
I'm your meal ticket, knee-deep in cheap fiction. You gloating ignoramus, you haven't any shame. Hey, I'm a famous Seamus, and most people don't know your name.